As we talked about in the beginning of this sequence, the path starts with view or deep belief system and understands that on the basis of what we believe or how we orient the world, our actions unfold from there, right? Based on how we see ourselves in relation to the whole. From there, our intentions toward action arise, and from our intention, our actions themselves, which the path plays out as speech, action, and livelihood, which we've been talking about for the last month or so. From there, which is a kind of increasing diameter circle, right? From like deep worldview, which is almost like my inner compass, my deep guiding star, to mix metaphors. From there, my intentions are this first impulse toward, like, how should I live? What should I do? And from impulse, the impulse of intention, the way it's understood as a wholesome part of the path, is the intention toward non-harming, the intention toward letting go. And this springs out into the action limbs, which are oriented toward tilting or disciplining or maturing our actions in the direction of healing rather than harming, wholesome relationality rather than harmful relationality, ethics, in a word. These are the moral or ethical guidelines of the path. To speak in ways that are helping, not harming, to act, so not just speak, but really act in a way that is relational and engaged in a way that is healing rather than harming. And then our livelihood, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, really how in the economic world our actions spread out or radiate out from us in all directions, really touching all beings on this planet. And how understanding that or even admitting that becomes really a force in our lives as we understand that everything we do is interconnected with the whole ecosystem, human, animal, planetary, perhaps beyond that. That's the first five limbs of the eight. And from there, in an interesting turn, if we take this as a sequence where we've been expanding, understanding our effect in the world up till now, from view through intention through action all the way out to how we move energy through the whole world economically, communally, politically. The sequence then turns inward. And the last three limbs, again, last if we take them as a sequence, are concerned with the meditative or cultivation or contemplative side of the path. And those last three limbs are wise or right effort, mindfulness or awareness practice, and integration or concentration or unification of mind or body. And mind and body, mind body hyphen, mind body without a hyphen. So there's a first thing that I want to emphasize here, which is that the limbs as they're laid out, they take us through a pathway that goes something like figure out kind of what your basic orientation is, and then first look outward. This is, again, you can understand the limbs as things we practice them all at the same time. And I'm going to speak mostly about them as a sequence, a little bit as a developmental sequence. First, we can deal with our external actions. They are material, they're visible in a certain way. And I think in an important way, they reveal their effects in ways that are visible. If I say something unkind, I can see its effect pretty much immediately on another person's face. If I do something harmful, I can feel and see its effect pretty much immediately. Right? And then sometimes those effects travel far into the future, of course. Because of this, I think the ethical or action-oriented part of the path is also a way to practice seeing karma. Karma is the doctrine or model that describes how actions and their results are interwoven. How what we do is relational in the world, how it spills out, radiates out, how it touches others. And this is central to the whole project of waking up or realizing freedom from suffering, because the whole model is built on understanding that our actions have effects. Understanding that clinging gives rise to pain, right? Wanting something to sustain that can't gives rise to the pain of loss. Wanting something to cease that is based in conditions and is inevitable in this moment gives rise to the pain of resisting what's happening, resisting reality. So part of the training in looking at our actions and others' actions and how the material and relational and ecosystem world works, understanding that, starts to teach us this basic, very helpful orientation, which is that everything has a result. And those results create the conditions for the next moment in which there's a choice to do something, which will then have a result, etc., forever. So then as we come internal, the path suggests, the teaching suggests, the internal ecosystem is, in a systemic way, the same as the external. It's not different in kind from the external ecosystem. And so internally, where the material that we are working with is things like sensation, emotion, story, the states of mind, subtle energies through the my whole being. In this ecosystem, the internal ecosystem, the same process is at play. Actions have effects. Those effects create the conditions for the next moment, where there's choice or not, depending on how awake we are. And then again, that choice leads to action, that action leads to an effect, etc. So then, in the meditative practice, or the contemplative or personal discipline part of the path, the first of the three limbs is effort, wise or right effort. So the classical teaching of right effort from the early Buddhist tradition, which is the primary reference here, goes like this. I'll try to say it to you kind of as a quotation in the formal style of the early texts. When a practitioner is aware of the presence of a wholesome state, that practitioner should act in ways that preserve and increase that wholesome state. When a practitioner is aware that there is... Wait, did I say that right? When there is... Did I say wholesome? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. We'll start with wholesome. When there is a wholesome state present, the practitioner acts to preserve and increase that wholesome state. When there is a wholesome state that is not present, the practitioner acts to invoke that wholesome state. When there is an unwholesome state present, the practitioner acts to decrease and eliminate that unwholesome state. And when there is an unwholesome state not present, the practitioner acts to prevent the future arising of that unwholesome state. Got that?
Got it.
This is a crisp, technical, you know, cool reading of what the mind and heart do, right? So the spectra that we relate with here is first the spectrum of wholesome, unwholesome. In our meditation tonight, we played with pleasant, unpleasant, which is not the same thing, right? There can be an unpleasant state that is wholesome. For instance, the unpleasant state of looking directly at, you know, an action that I did that was, say, harmful, and now I feel embarrassed. It is unpleasant to confront that, but it's wholesome to do so, because I have to work through or process or find my way through that thing. Likewise, there are pleasant states that are unwholesome. You may have found your way into a few of those in your lifetime. If you haven't, I'm sure there's a guy down in the corner who will sell you some. But it's not even just that. There are pleasant states that are unwholesome that are things like, you know, what? Binge watching several seasons of something, you know, in that kind of like foggy but sort of tripping way. Depends what it is, whether it's really wholesome or unwholesome. Okay. But you get where we're going. Pleasant and unpleasant are actually, in a sense, just instinctive responses to stimulus. And they can be learned, right? Right now, the taste of Brussels sprouts, especially nicely sautéed in coconut oil with the right amount of salt, very pleasurable. When I was a teenager, unpleasurable, right? Wholesome in either case, because Brussels sprouts are good for you. They seem to be good for me. So wholesome, but pleasant and unpleasant fluctuates. So we're not looking at pleasant, unpleasant, and it's important in practice. And this is an ascetic practice, meaning it's a discipline that forces us to change our relationship to pleasure and pain. It's necessary to unhinge, if we can, in our beings, an automatic assumption that pleasant is wholesome and unpleasant is unwholesome, right? We actually have to learn how to differentiate those qualities. This is partly why this is an addiction model or an anti-addiction model. And we'll talk about that some other time. Right? But partly we need to learn that this particular pleasure is actually painful at its root, and feel that. So the spectrum that we're working on is wholesome, unwholesome, and that takes some study, particularly because we're in a culture that doesn't teach morality very well. It teaches a certain kind of Puritan repression rather vigorously, and then contradicts that by being sort of pornographically licentious and violent at nearly every turn. That's very confusing, right? We come from some traditions, whether you come from a European lineage or an Asian lineage or a global South lineage anywhere. Most, every traditional culture that I know of has a body of ethical teachings that are often quite similar and in many ways quite well fleshed out. And the soup of how that has gotten kind of goulashed into postmodern America is, that's a bad food metaphor, is messy, right? How do you act? What is it to act wisely? So this, again, is partly why the ethical limbs come first. We practice following the precepts. If I don't know what it means, what a wholesome or unwholesome state means, it's a good practice to just start by going, well, what happens if I try not to hurt people? And what does that feel like? So wholesome states, may or may not feel good. They often do. And as we get into it, they feel better and better because we can feel their effects. They change us as we hang out in them. Wholesome states incline toward well-being, toward healing, toward goodness, toward non-harm. Again, wholesome states loop back to intention, to wise intention, right? The intention to not harm, the intention toward generosity, toward renunciation, letting go. There are also, within the tradition, within the Buddhist tradition, lists of wholesome and unwholesome states. This is tremendously useful. And this is because you can't really trust your intuition on this one. Especially in, this is a hard thing to say, in sort of New Age California, where there's a lot of like, trust your gut kind of messages out there. Trust your intuition. Get in touch with your deep intuition. This is a particular place, discerning what's wholesome and unwholesome, where my general guideline is to not trust my intuition until it's really well trained. And this is because intuition is a way of saying impulse or instinct. And instinct is our animal reflex to stay safe at all costs. And what that means is that the thing I would be trusting, especially if I'm wounded, and who's not, I would be trusting basically a nervous system that is scared and a little bit overwhelmed most of the time. And so if I trusted my intuition would be, you know, retreat to a cabin in the woods, don't talk to anybody. And, you know, and kind of be grumpy all the time, because doesn't the world suck? That's my intuition. But I know enough. I don't know, it took a couple decades of practice to figure this one out. I know enough to be like, oh, that's not actually my, like, whatever, true nature, deep, intuitive heart calling. That's my sympathetic nervous system. That's fight and flight. That's flight, particularly, because that's the side I prefer. You know, run away! I trust it as a barometer of my well-being. Like, I trust that it's honest. When I get that impulse, I'm like, oh, look, I'm scared. Or look, I'm overwhelmed. That's the part to trust. It's a marker of the state that you're in. So when I have the thought, run away from this interaction, the information it gives me is accurate. And the information is not that I should run away. The information is that I'm scared, that I'm triggered, that I'm activated. So that's the thing to trust. But you don't trust its guidelines. Because, you know, the thing that I'm usually scared of is not actually that I'm being attacked by a mountain lion or that the fascists are coming. They're sort of not coming. So, sort of. But you don't need to flee for the hills yet. And anyway, they're there more than they're here. So they have the cabins in the woods. So you should stay in Berkeley if you really... I don't know. I hear Berkeley's actually not doing so well recently. Anyway, but sorry.
Hashtag fascist digression.
Hashtag fascist digression. Man. Yeah. Yeah. Hashtag, you know, 2020 can't come soon enough. Okay. The guideline on discerning the wholesome and unwholesome suggests that it takes some training to know which is which. Therefore, we have lists to suggest to you which is which. Right? So there's lists like the list of the 7 enlightenment qualities, which are mindfulness, investigation, joy, rapture, peacefulness, concentration, equanimity, Right? These are qualities that you can just trust are wholesome. There's the list of the hindrances, right? Grasping at sense pleasure, anger and hatred, dullness and sloth, laziness, restlessness and worry, doubt and skepticism. Not the good kind of skepticism from the skeptical philosophical school of the Greeks, but bad skepticism like I think I suck and I'm not going to ever make it. That kind of doubt. These are unwholesome qualities. And as you study, you could be like, oh, it's really good that I have a list of these things because I get deluded sometimes, right? So, spectrum. Wholesome, unwholesome, learn which is which. And then state, wholesome or unwholesome state. State is a way of talking about the totality of your experience in any given moment. It's most easy to think about state as a kind of emotional state or charge. So like anger is a totality state, or peacefulness is a totality kind of state. So wholesome and unwholesome states are happening. Your actions have something to do with which ones are happening, not everything. Your actions plus general conditions, plus your past, etc., plus everything. And then the guideline in wise effort is to be active. This is the really important piece that separates this type of contemplative instruction from types of instruction that you may have heard and enjoyed even from non-dual traditions. This is not a Zen instruction. It's not an Advaita instruction. And this is basically two different ways to practice. The non-dual way says, let everything come and go because it's all already perfect. All you have to do is not worry about what's happening. And you're already there. Because you're already there. I'll lay that teaching on you with some force at some point, in a way that it's also true, which is beautiful, one of the beautiful things about it. Those teachings are true. The Zen practice that suggests everything will come and go on its own. Simply maintaining a kind of spacious presence is all that's needed. These teachings are very, very attractive because they're simple. They resonate with some deep part of our hearts, I think, as true. And when we can touch into them, and we often touch into them in a kind of flash of opening, they feel, and I think are, profoundly liberating. The trouble with them is that they're fleeting, and they incline towards spiritual bypass, because they are non-relational, non-engaged, and they don't process anything. You won't process your childhood or your emotions or your relationship doing absolute realm practice. They're really good practices if you're on retreat for a month or however long. But then you have to reintegrate into relationships and this world when you come back. As a contrast to that, this teaching I'm offering you tonight, the wise effort teaching from the early tradition, is a very active teaching. It's not really passive mindfulness. You're not just observing stuff as it's happening. You're observing, discerning where you are on the wholesome and unwholesome spectrum, and then preserving and increasing the wholesome, invoking the wholesome if it's not there, decreasing the unwholesome, and preventing it. Yeah. So how do we do this? The main way that I suggested tonight in the meditation, and again, this is the beginning of the internal aspect of the path, is that we begin to learn that placing our attention in different places shifts us on the pleasant-unpleasant spectrum. That's a first step to learn how where we put our attention has an effect. And then as we do that and we start to learn, you know, what the wholesome states feel like, what the unwholesome states feel like, we start to have this really beautiful, this becomes a little internal dance. This is an engaged internal meditative kind of like little warmth-seeking creature. And what I'm doing is essentially this. I'm oscillating between mindfulness of state and then what to do about it. With the goal being deeper ease, more wholesomeness, basically. Deeper ease, deeper joy. If my nature is to be kind of buzzy, I'm going to practice more tranquility. If my nature is to be really dull, I'm going to practice more uplifted energy. They're both wholesome. So here's a little made-up demo. Here's a little authentic demo. I won't even make it up. Because you can do this all the time. It's not just meditative. How's my state? I feel basically physically comfortable and kind of joyful. I love this topic. And then my state shifts because a little bit of doubt enters and wonders if I'm explaining it well enough. And a teeny bit of critique of kind of going on too long, which I recognize, very common for me, I recognize it. As that comes in, my state shifts and it's somewhat less joyful, it contracts a little bit. In relation to that, I'm making the choice to open my eyes. And I'm going to take a breath more intentionally. As I do, like something just subtly brightens in the sort of upper mid-range, and kind of impulsively my eyes kind of opened to connect with some of your eyes. And that's pleasurable, and it also kind of grounds some part of the little vibration of that. Having done that, and I perceive it as a little kind of wave, like, how am I doing? What's it like? I go through a little like, and it kind of settles. And there's a sort of grounding and gathering. I feel happy. I might then decide, okay, now let's close the eyes again. And now it's quieter. There's a sort of simple sort of hum. I can hear kind of background noises, and my mind's quieter than it was before, kind of just a soft field. Sensing that, I notice that it's tranquil. I know that that's wholesome, it's also pleasurable. And based in that, I'm going to make the choice for another moment to increase that wholesome state by allowing myself to relax more fully into it and settle back a little bit. I notice that doing that, the breath comes with a little more openness. And then I noticed a tiny flicker of something like pride, because I didn't used to be able to do this, like relax. Mm-hmm. And then a tiny flicker of doubt of wondering whether it's wholesome to be sharing it with you so honestly. But having said that, it shifts back to I'm like, okay, I'm just experimenting, I think it's good. And then it settles again. So sometimes, in a very active way, that's how I meditate. Is I'm actually, and if I'm a little bit distracted, I'll use the words. I'll actually talk myself that little monologue. Right? I'll be like, oh, it's a little tranquil. Now I can just settle into it a little. Oh, but look, a flicker of doubt. You know, and it's just like, because that's what's happening anyway. the mindfulness instructions say, notice all of that. And all that this limb, the wise effort limb, suggests is notice it and engage with it. Engage with it gently, just a little bit. And maybe the biggest thing to watch out for is thinking that you have to do too much, right? Because it's not like, oh, my mind wandered a little bit. Oh, maybe I should jump up and do a few sun salutations, right? That's too strong a medicine for the mind flickering. If I was like, oh, I'm so sleepy, I just can't stay awake, and there's this like deep dullness through my cells, I feel just like a mud puddle. I might be like, get up, you know, and like really lift it up, right? So I want my intervention to match the intensity of the state, yeah? And the smallest, this is a titration principle, this is where I'll end for today, the smallest intervention needed to shift the needle. Right? So if I can change my state back toward the wholesome, or if I can unstick an unwholesome state simply by just really, really a teeny little lift in the sternum and a moment of opening the eyes, that's really nice in the meditative field, and then I can resettle. So wise effort in sitting, and then as a principle, you start to see it everywhere, right? Everything unfolds through our state. And in a sense, the entire practice is a shepherding of wholesome states through my system and then out into the larger system. What could we do? The smallest intervention needed to shift the system toward a more wholesome. I'll use the California word, vibration. So thanks. Taking in just a moment to do it. Note your state. And notice that all the tiny things we do, like a little teeny bit of sitting up or adjusting my posture, those are all little state interventions. So do whatever you want and see what its effect is. So, some space for responses, reflections, curiosities, your experience.
Anna. The smallest intervention needed based on the principle of conservation of energy. I mean, I get it that not to, like,
yeah,
swing like a pendulum unnecessarily,
yep,
but
mm-hmm, just
sometimes. Sometimes you could do little or medium or big, and sometimes you maybe want to go big. Why necessarily smallest?
In this context, because what we're going toward is teaching the system or giving the ecosystem the best conditions for self-regulation, for non-effortful regulation. Where regulation is easeful oscillation between the poles of energy, whatever is available to me in this moment. So discomfort isn't freaking me out, pleasure isn't making me a cuckoo bird. And perhaps one vision of a liberated state is that I don't need to intervene in my system very much. I'm just existing, joyfully engaged in existence, or peacefully, or whatever wholesome quality you favor. And so then using the smallest intervention needed is a way of teaching my system that it can do it on its own for the most part. It's a big thing in some kinds of therapy and work to to have a few strong interventions and come to rely on them. Right? That, and they can become crutches. And so in a sense, I'm both doing the practice of wise effort, but I'm also weaning myself from effortful effort as I do it. Lest I think that, you know, every time I have a single flickering of an unwholesome thought, I have to, like, bang out 10 Hail Marys or, you know, like, take a really deep breath and lock my scapula to my back ribs. And then I just would think that I have to do that over and over. So, as little as possible. And I like, you know, I like thinking about this in relation to, you know, larger systems, political systems, ecosystems, of like, you know, I'd rather do, you know, a little tiny controlled burn than like introduce a crazy non-native species to sort of control something, right? Like, I'm not godly enough with the ecosystem to trust myself to make bigger and bigger interventions. I'd rather do less. Yeah. What else? Ben?
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the quality of attentive mind. Of sort of you often use the adjective bright to describe a quality of mind.
Yeah.
I was wondering in this context how that works. I remember hearing about a bright quality of mind and becoming maybe a little bit concerned that it was something to become too attached to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm a little curious about the relationship between that kind of state and becoming attached to state.
Yeah, those are sort of two different questions. One about the sort of particular qualities of attention, or what attentive mind is, and then the good question about states, which is like, doesn't wise effort encourage us to become attached to wholesome states? Because we're certainly being encouraged to invoke and maintain and increase them. I'll answer that one first because it's easier. The simile given by the Buddha is just as a skilled carpenter removes a coarse peg by means of a finer one, so does one first remove an unwholesome state by the imposition of a wholesome one. And then, as practice progresses, the more and more intense states themselves fall away as no longer necessary. Until in a practice of increasing subtlety. So like the initial wholesome states to cultivate are things like rapturous joy. And once you get good at rapturous joy, you're instructed to like have a blast, right? So you get meditators sitting there with like just like orgasmic radiation energy through their whole beings. Sounds awesome. And after a relatively short time, it's a little too much. It's jangly. It's not actually as pleasurable as we thought when we weren't having any. So then you let go of that and it settles into happiness, which is subtler than rapture. When one teacher of mine hit this subtle happiness, which is a concentration state, she said it was like the most profound contentment with everything. It was like I was floating through the world on clouds of subtle bliss. And I thought to myself, there's no way I could ever get sick of this. And she said, so I floated through, she's on a retreat, I floated through a retreat center on clouds for 3 weeks without a break, just 24/7, blissful sweetness. And she said, without any thought that it was going to happen or when it might happen, suddenly one day there was just a moment when the feeling came, enough. And with that, the state settled and shifted, and the next state in the sequence is equanimity, right? The balanced heart in relation to pleasure and pain, which is profoundly pleasurable, but a quieter pleasure than happiness. And it goes on from there. So in general, because this is a system that inclines toward liberation, where liberation is the extinguishing of all attachment. In a very subtle way, it doesn't mean the extinguishing of connection or joy or relationality. It just means the extinguishing of the pain of gripping. Then states and practices go from gross to subtle. So then, get attached to a finer state than the one you're currently attached to, and continue that practice all the way, until the very last thing is an extremely subtle sense called the I am, which you get a little attached to. You might find yourself attached to the intuition, I am. And when that itself falls away, it's considered the last state. So they say, feel free to get attached, because you will feel the painfulness of the state eventually, the non-finality of it eventually. It's not actually liberation. It's just pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And so then, once you notice that it's not actually your goal, it falls away. It mm-hmm. shifts. The start of your question was about attentive mind, and it's a really nice question to try to define it. Of course, there's no particular word doctrinally that means attention, but there's certain ones. The phrase in the text goes, the meditator sits down in an open place at the root of a tree or on a heap of straw or in an empty hut, and crossing their legs, setting the body upright, the meditator brings mindfulness to the fore, where mindfulness is actually the word for memory or recollection, brings recollection to the foreground. Bringing recollection to the foreground, the meditator cultivates recollection, clear comprehension, and ardency, ardent effort, ardent engagement. So that's the description of attention that one comes to. It has the quality of remembering or recollecting, which is to say, we think of memories as being in the past, but what it really just means is our mind is connecting with a moment, any moment. So we bring connecting to the foreground, and it has with it a quality of clear comprehension. The word is sampajana, if you're tracking that. This is sati sampajana, mindfulness and clear comprehension. And this is a quality where attention both is connected to something, that's the mindfulness piece, and in a certain way understands it, which is subtle, right? What does that mean? In a certain way, it seems to mean sees it for what it is, at least on the relative level. Right? So I connect with the breath, and I know that when there's an in-breath, it's an in-breath. I don't get confused. I'm not just spacey with the breath, be like, yeah, I'm kind of breathing. But I know clearly that an in-breath is an in-breath, that an out-breath is an out-breath. Right? There's a discernment quality. So there's these two wings to it, where there's memory itself, where there's the, if we even leave out that there's a thing that's connecting with a thing, which imputes a self that's not there, we can say there arises in the field of consciousness the awareness of a moment in time. And we call that memory or recollecting. And then along with that, if there's the full quality invoked in the text, this is one of the deepest wholesome qualities, there is the clear comprehension of that, knowing it for what it is. So like when it's a memory of the past, there's the knowing that it's past. Right? And if that's really strong, that's gonna keep us from things like, you know, fantasy and nostalgia and getting lost in like replaying the past again and again, because you could just be like, that's past. So that's one of the sort of definitions of kind of attention or the attentive mind. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Other thoughts or recollections here? And I might also say, just in our last few minutes, any responses to this particular kind of meditation that we did, which I know from having been around, is a pretty different instruction than either I often give, but then often is given almost anywhere. To be active moment to moment, shaping your experience toward the wholesome. Well, what's that like? What was that like? Any sort of kind of curiosity in there? Yeah, Lisa.
Well, it's startling to me a little bit in how I'm usually focused on what I'm doing out there rather than being aware of my state and taking an action for my state. It's more like I should be doing this and that and getting this done.
Yeah.
But the idea that the ethical, the wholesome thing to do is to sort of navigate my states in the way you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Totally makes sense, and I'm just startled by what a shift that is, really, from my intuitive way of doing things.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. It is a shift. It is. We want to notice both, like, what I'm doing out there, and I want to notice if I'm doing it from a place of ease or anxiety or worry or grasping or whatever it is.
Yeah, that will affect, of course, the quality of the outward action that you do, so that you're, like, addressing the roots of it, really.
It absolutely addresses the roots. It affects the quality of the outward thing you do. It also is the thing that inclines toward liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Doing things externally from whatever state and not knowing the state affects the external, but it doesn't do much for liberation.
Right? Yeah.
If I do all sorts of good actions, but I'm an anxious wreck,
yeah.
I've done good actions, which is good, but I'm not serving my own process.
Yeah.
Right? And in order to serve my own process, I'm going to need to both do something to shift my state out of anxiety. And part of doing that might be even recognizing the good that I've done, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not that it was wrong to do good. It's wonderful to do good. So I might be like, oh, I've served so many people. Let me just pause for a moment and really take that in. That's beautiful. And the pausing and the taking it in is going to shift my state out of the anxiety, hopefully, perhaps, if it's strong enough, and into a kind of appreciation, which is a wholesome state.
Yeah.
Right.
And that shift toward when you said that this is for liberation, that shift to focusing on that.
Yes.
Is also a shift.
It is.
Because it's something
is.
Internal rather than what's seen. And
it is.
I just really like hearing it. really like that encouragement.
Good. That's the encouragement. And that shift of orienting toward liberation, of course, takes us back to the first two limbs, takes us back to wise view and wise intention. That's where the whole thing started. This is a way of saying, if I'm not oriented toward liberation, if that's not part of my view, wise effort in this sense isn't going to make sense. Right? If my view is just, I'm a cog in the machine and I've got to jam the machine in order to get things done, and it doesn't matter my state, I can sacrifice myself for that thing, I'm not holding the view of my liberation as being wholesome for the world. I'm holding some other view.
Yeah.
And based on my view, I will take actions in that way. And so the whole structure of the Eightfold Path is based in wise view. And if you have a different view, the other limbs don't work the same way. Right? Every view does its own kinds of effort. Right? If my view is smash the state, doesn't matter what happens to me, then wise effort is going to be increase those actions that smash the state and decrease those actions that preserve the state.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because effort comes directly out of view and intention.
I see, yeah.
Yeah? So if you want to shift your life, one of the places to dream into is not first, what should I do to shift it, but what do I believe about my life? What's my view about who I am and why we're here and that? Right? Go on, do the vision quest first rather than the job applications, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right on. Thank you for being here. It's really a pleasure to work our way through this path together. Next week we'll talk about the seventh of the limbs. Coming out of this conversation and effort, we'll go into mindfulness, wise mindfulness, or awareness practice. I will kindly but sternly smack down corporate mindfulness, and I will propose, in the way that I'm talking to you, Lisa, right now, clarifying the view will clarify our vision of what mindfulness is and could be useful for. And we'll go on from there into concentration and et cetera, onward into liberation and smashing the state. As always, we operate on the subtle and profound practice of gift economy. Your generosity both is a proposal to your deep clinging self that it's okay to let go willingly, joyfully, and is a gift for the well-being of others to come and practice and to maintain a group like this for the future. So thank you for your generosity. And the baskets on the shelf for offerings. Picnic on May 28th, and I'm here now for the next couple months without a break, as far as I know. So see you next week. Enjoy the summer sun.